Our reading today is from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 to 11. The words of the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. And now we'll turn to Ecclesiastes 12, verses 9 to 14. Not only was the teacher wise, but also he imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads. Their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil.
Thank you very much, Talia, for reading for us. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Chris Wigram. I'm on the leadership team of this church. And if you're not familiar with our pattern here, we do a book of the month. And this month, the book is Ecclesiastes. And the question that we have to face is this. Usually the Bible is full of purpose and meaning, and yet here we are confronted with meaninglessness. So what is going on in this book? It is important to understand that we have two speakers in the book. One is the teacher who teaches from chapter 1, verse 12 to chapter 12, verse 8, which is the majority of the book. He ends with a reflection on death. And the second speaker is what we might call the frame narrator, who covers the passages that we've just had read to us. You may have noticed in verse 12 of chapter 12, he talks to his son and reflects on what the teacher has said. He describes him as a person who is wise. What is the teacher's message? Life is hard, and then you die. Work, pleasure, relationship, status, money, wisdom, death are all discussed. He concludes at times that life is unfair. In chapter 3, when he considers the timing of things, there is a time under season, you will know that passage probably. His evaluation of the situation is that God has not let us know when the right time is for something, but he has put chapter 3, verse 11, extremely important verse in Ecclesiastes, he has put eternity in our hearts. The writer of Ecclesiastes is not an atheist. Atheism is a very recent development. And when the Bible says, the fool says there is no God, Psalm 14, for example, what they mean is not that people are intellectually not believing in God, but they are acting as if God does not exist. That means that there are a lot more atheists in the world than you think there are. The teacher says, be careful around God in chapter 5. Guard your steps when you go near to the house of God. God is there and he can cause you trouble. If you offer a vow, pay for it. There's all sorts of interesting conundrums in the book of Ecclesiastes, and I don't really have to go into them this morning, because even though this is the book of the month, we're also going to be going into a series on Ecclesiastes in the next few weeks. One of the things that Ecclesiastes says to people living under the sun is, enjoy your life, seize the day, carpe diem. Make the most of it. It is a wonderful privilege to be here. When we look at the frame narrator, and we'll be looking at him more in detail in a minute, especially verses 1 to 11, we see that the teacher is a voice of authority. You need to be exposed to this because he pondered things and wrote truth. If you look in chapter 12, verse 10, it says, the teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. You have to accept that this is life under the sun. You will not find the meaning of life here, but if you want an answer to life, look above the sun, which is how he ends the book in verses 12, 13, and 14. And that is the perspective that we all need. It is so easy for us just to live under the sun. We need that perspective that takes our eyes off all the details and the intrigues and intricacies of this world and look above to the living God. And he says, the perspective you need, verse 13, fear God, keep his commandments. Remember, you are not the center of life. The world does not revolve around you. You're just a part. He's arguing for God to be supreme in your life. And verse 14, God will bring every deed into judgment. Live in the light of that. Live in the light of future judgment. Other parts of the Bible say, flee from the wrath that is to come. This is wise teaching for people living in this world. It's possible that Ecclesiastes was one of the last of the books of the Old Testament to be written. Many scholars think that in verse 11, when he talks about the words of the wise, this is an allusion to the law, the prophets, and the writings, i.e., to all the material we have in the whole Old Testament. So what he's basically saying is, look to God's revelation. Here it is, we're summing up everything that's there in the Old Testament. Here is Ecclesiastes, which is going to put the pinnacle on the writing of the Old Testament, and now you need to look to the words of the wise, because these words of the wise, verse 11, are given by one shepherd. And in verse 12, he says, don't go anywhere else for understanding about God. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Well, we all know that, especially at exam time. But be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. And of course, the book of Revelation affirms that particular perspective, that we should not accept any revelation that comes after the end of the scriptures. And you will be aware that there are many religious systems that have come after the end of the writing of the scriptures. And the scriptures are consistent. They warn us, don't accept them. They are not truth. They are not worth listening to. So let's begin with the frame narrator and look at what I would call in verses 1:1-3, frustration experienced. Now, have you had anything frustrating to happen to you this week? I mean, has anything slightly annoyed you? I won't give a little poll, but, you know, what frustrates you in daily life? Is it when things don't work out as planned, or when elections don't go quite the way you think they should? Or when people don't return your calls, even though you've put 4 messages on their answering machine? Or you're stuck with an answering machine when you want to talk to a person? I heard this once on an answering machine. This is not an answering machine, it is a questioning machine. There are only 2 questions in life that are relevant. Who are you and what do you want? Most people don't know the answer to these questions. Please give your answer at the sound of the tone. That's pretty good, isn't it? We immediately see how important the theme of frustration and meaninglessness is for the book when it is repeated 3 times for emphasis as the narrator asks the ultimate question in verse 3 of chapter 1. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? What is the point of life? And all around us, brothers and sisters, we have to be realistic. There is a sense of ennui, a sense of angst, a sense of world weariness as people survey the world around them. What is the gain of it all? Verse 3. So I would want to say that one of the reasons that Ecclesiastes was written is to give you an idea of the pointlessness of life which is lived just under the sun. Under the sun is a phrase that comes up many times in the book. And at the same time, Ecclesiastes argues for what you would call a theistic view of the world. And as it does that, it takes us on a tour of life's experiences. And over the next few weeks, we're going to learn from some of those experiences. The second part of the bit that the frame narrator teaches us here, verses 4 to 11, is that frustration is built into our creation. It's built into what you might call nature and history. Life is brief. The future arrives too quickly. People come and go, but the world grinds on. We've got a daily, today we have a wonderful example of that, don't we? Today it's one in, one out. Marion Holford died a couple of nights ago, and we had a new baby come into the church a couple of days ago. That's how life is. People die, people are born. He looks at creation. He looks at the sun, it does its daily course. The wind blows where it wills, it goes round and round. The water flows into the sea. The scientists define physical laws that have always operated, but if we ask them about origin or some ultimate purpose, there's nothing they can tell us from nature that will ask that question or answer that question. A couple of us were at a lecture on Wednesday night by Alistair McGrath on the meaning of life. Had the same title, with special reference to Richard Dawkins and C.S. Lewis. And the lecturer made that point. He says, science can give you evidence, it can have theories, it can revise its theories, but it can't tell you why you're here. It can't give you a meaning for what you're doing here. And we know from the Bible that the biblical view of nature testifies to a creator, though it doesn't compel that everyone has to believe him. But the narrator here is concerned with proof rather than testimony, and rightly maintains that meaning and security cannot be found in nature alone. If everything goes round and round, if everything is endlessly cyclical, how can we break out of the temporal circle into a state of something that actually leads somewhere? And this, brothers and sisters, is one of the great contributions of Christianity in the world, is that it challenged all those philosophies which are cyclical and believe in things like reincarnation, because it said there is a beginning and there is an end. And you need to know that. It does not go round and round. The world does not go round and round in terms of ultimate questions. It may do on a daily 24-hour basis, but this world is not going to be here forever. And therefore, you need to think about these different things. He goes on, life without God is stressful. Verse 8, it's wearying. Without God, history is a closed circuit, a world without windows, someone has said. The ear and the eye are never satisfied in verse 8. The poet, I think his name is Simon Turner, said, history repeats itself, has to. No one listens. Verse 10, is there anything new under the sun? Rick Warren says, everything seems new if you are ignorant of history. And brothers and sisters, we as Christians are getting extremely ignorant of church history. And church history is one of those great foundations which God has given us to remind ourselves that when a new fad comes into the church, you've seen it somewhere before. You don't have to follow the fads and the different distractions that come into our lives because you're centered on the Word of God. That reminds us of that. And of course, verse 11, we quickly forget people and events. There's no remembrance of men of old. Even those who are yet to come will not be. And I was thinking about this. You know, take someone, I could mention a number of people. What about last year when everyone was going on about all the superstars who died last year in 26? It was such a tragic year. So many superstars died. It was horrible. How many of them can you relate? How many of you know how many died? Who are they? Who were they? Tell me now. It's only a year ago. You've forgotten. That is how fleeting life is. You think of a political hero a few years ago. I was thinking of Tony Benn the other day. Remember him? He died. Who thinks of Tony Benn? Who takes any care of his philosophy? He was a great politician. He was a huge politician when I was a student. He was influencing this, influencing that, but he's gone. He's gone. And people do not remember. Don't think people are going to remember you. Because they're not. Well, one or two people might. But I mean, when you read the obituaries and things like that, I find that absolutely fascinating. It's probably because I'm getting older and getting closer to my own. But the obituary is just fascinating, you know. All these wonderful achievements, pages and pages in the paper about particular achievements. A couple of weeks later, everyone's forgotten. So that really shows us that wisdom under the sun is not enough. And I want to put this story into context. We are told that the reflections come from King Solomon. We know that he's a man of wisdom and wide experience. We know that he's part of the biblical story. He knows that in Genesis, God put his people, his creation, in charge of the world. He knows that Adam and Eve are active in the Garden of Eden, and then they rebel against God, and the world plunges into disaster. And then God works through Abraham to bring into being a nation that will be a blessing to the nations. And he shows them proof of this by giving them the law and showing them how to live wisely. That's what the law's for. We've just done Deuteronomy. That was an exercise in 10 weeks of learning how to live as wise Christians. And then you think, when the people were in the land, when Solomon and David were at the high point of life, it says of Israel, 1 Kings 4, 20-21, they ate, they drank, and they were happy. And if you stopped at that point of history, you might conclude that Israel had arrived. We might ask this question, is Solomon the new Adam? This is what we're waiting for. This is the promised seed. Is Solomon the one? Is he the one who's brought everything together? He's established a government. He's wise. He's got everything that's going for him. Is this land in Israel, is this a new Eden? Is Solomon a wise ruler? 1 Kings 4:30 says he was. And if we thought that, we would be missing the point, because what Ecclesiastes deals with, exactly that life that Solomon lived. It was under the sun, it was vanity, and it was striving after the wind. And I don't know if you've ever tried to catch the wind, but it's not an easy thing to do. So what we have here in Ecclesiastes is wisdom plugged into reality. It's wisdom required for life outside the Garden of Eden. This book also, like Deuteronomy, should help us to relate to the world out there. It is also iconoclastic. Now, I put the definition up there just in case you don't know what an iconoclastic person is, but it basically means you criticize cherished people, symbols, or institutions. And in the first two chapters of Ecclesiastes, you find that Solomon has many self-references to himself, I, this, that, and the other. Solomon is the founder of Israel's wisdom history, yet here he is floundering. And what we see in Ecclesiastes is that Solomon is demythologized, he's deflated. And brothers and sisters, do we not need a bit more of this in our contemporary society? Do we not need to be a bit more rigorous in dealing with the icons and celebrities of our time who try endlessly to obscure their fallen humanity but fail every time? Have you listened to some of the testimonies of the sad, sad situations of the people who've died in the recent terrorist attacks? It's an awful situation, but when you read their testimonies, you would think they were perfect. They're not, brothers and sisters. Original sin says those people are not perfect. Neither are we. And we should not be deceived by mawkish sentimentality when it comes to the death of people in atrocious events. We should still be realistic as Christians when we make a contribution in that particular area. Christians do that as well. We write hagiographies. Have you heard of those? Hagiography is when you take a Christian leader and you paint a picture. I did some research into Hudson Taylor, and I can tell you some of the stuff on Hudson Taylor was a hagiography. It made him seem perfect. But he wasn't. And no one else is. We're all fallen human beings with feet of clay. Ecclesiastes reminds us of that. It tells us of that. And Solomon concludes in verse 13 that the frustration is from God. He said, I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heaven. And what a heavy burden God has laid on men. And what I want to say strongly is that I am glad that if you are not a Christian, I hope you continue to be frustrated and confounded. Why? So those little events in your lives that stop you from doing what you want or getting your ambition fulfilled or whatever it happens to be, those events don't stop you asking questions about life, that there is an answer to all of this down here. If you are maybe a frustrated Christian, then you already know the answer. And what you need to do is to fill your mind more and more with God's perspective, not your own. That will change you. And then Solomon goes on, verse 14, we aim at things that can so easily be blown away. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun, all of them are meaningless, are chasing after the wind. And he realizes that human reason is limited. Verses 16 to 18. I thought to myself, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who's ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. No one could have done more than Solomon did to understand. He's very experienced. But he admits both wisdom and folly are hard to pin down. And in verse 18, he admits something that actually, with much wisdom comes much sorrow, and more grief, and more knowledge, the more grief. What he's saying there is, I'm actually worse off because I know too much. I'm worse off because I actually think about this life and I can't solve the conundrums of this life, and therefore I wish I could live in the present, but all these things come in and they make me live in the future and they make me be concerned about the past. I see more problems than solutions. I see righteous people getting persecuted. I see corrupt officials. I see bad men getting away with things. The world is full of bad luck, and despite all my effort and despite all the wisdom that God has given me, talented as I am, I don't always get to the top. And I sometimes find that stupid people have been given authority over me. So what do you do? What do you do when you conclude that this is the state of things under the sun? Pleasure. Laughter, mirth, superficial gaiety, canned laughter. I don't know if you've seen the film Educating Rita. There's one brilliant scene in there where she's advancing in her life under the tutelage of the professor. And she's obviously, at the same time, being moved into a different dimension with all her friends. And she's sitting in a pub with her friends, and they're all drinking beer, and they're all laughing, and you can see she's just not into it any longer. All the laughter and gaiety is going on around her, but she's changing. She's changing. And the pleasure of that moment is taken away from her because she's changing in her thinking. And of course, when you think of pleasure, you think of people like, I mean, we've got trillions of comedians around these days. Most of them are, you know, incredibly funny, and a lot of them got a lot of insight. But how many of them live tragic lives? How many of them have tragic deaths? Quite a lot. But there's something more serious here. We can give ourselves individually to pleasure. But I've just been reading a book, which Tony's got at the moment, The Strange Death of Europe. In that book, he says that our whole culture has given itself over to pleasure. And people do that when they've lost their gods. A philosopher observed, the great collapse of ideals often draws in its wake a kind of cynicism. If all hope is lost, then let us have fun. If you know the story of the leaders of the Soviet Union, when they realized that their system was not working any longer, they just gave themselves over to pleasure. What about something a little bit more contemporary? There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. That was on the side of a bus going around the streets of London. I.e., enjoy yourself. Give yourself over to pleasure. That's all you do. You've lost faith. You've got nothing to believe in. You've got no God to follow. All you can do is give yourself over to pleasure. So you might go clubbing. Verse 3. Be the life and the soul of the party. Where's wisdom at a party? You might do projects and achievements. You might believe that awful phrase, which you sometimes hear but not so often nowadays, he who has the most toys wins. Isn't that horrible? Isn't that just horrible? He who has the most toys wins. Because the answer is, you'll lose big time. Look at Luke 12. Look at Jesus' parable of the person, the farmer, who put all his grain and everything in the barns, built bigger barns, got himself into the top position in his society. And Jesus says, you fool, your heart is required from you. Tonight, you're going to die. And the wisdom teacher here talks about farming, he talks about women, he talks about trade, he talks about music. There's pictures of unparalleled luxury. And I think probably when Solomon remarked that he took on some great projects, it's sort of like Bill Gates saying he made a few dollars. It's a bit of an understatement, isn't it? Solomon built the temple of God, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Talk about an achievement. Wouldn't you be proud of that if one of your buildings was the seventh wonder of the ancient world? Yet it's almost impossible to ignore the depressed, melancholy tone behind his words. There's no joy, there's no gladness. It's as though Solomon looks at the temple he built, shrugs his shoulders, and walks away. So much for projects. There is, of course, some temporary reward, at least under the sun. Verse 10 of chapter 2, I denied myself nothing, my eyes desired, I refused my heart no pleasure, my heart took delight in all my work, this was the reward for all my labor. So there's a temporary reward, do what you want, do what you like, enjoy the achievements, but actually, what have you gained from that? Often the result of all of this is boredom and a dissatisfaction. That's why I referred to the ennui of people's lives. And actually, when people get bored and dissatisfied, that's the point where we have an opportunity to talk to them. So there's something here that gives you meaning. You don't need to be bored and dissatisfied. You can live with purpose. Someone said, boredom is the window to infinity. It is authentic. It is life without God. But if someone steps into your life and says there is a way to find purpose, you can listen to them. But of course, we come to the ultimate frustration, death, verse 14. I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head while the fool walks in the darkness. I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this is meaningless, for the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered in days to come. Both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. Woody Allen said, none of us will get out of this alive. François Mitterrand, is that what he was, François? What annoys me is not knowing what comes next. That's what he said. And a society which hides death from the eyes of the living and covers it up like a lion and removes it from everyday life does not glorify or preserve life, but corrupts it. And we do that in our society. We try to hide death, the reality of death, from people. But our wise teacher here says death comes to both the fool and the wise. Neither are going to be remembered. How many funerals have you attended? How many of those tributes can you remember? Not many. But 2 days ago, a Christian died. And that is hugely different from the general atmosphere of the Europe that we now live in. Because in the 16th century, for example, when John Donne died, one of his friends said, his body, which was once a temple of the Holy Spirit, i.e. was a believer, and has now become a quantity of Christian dust, i.e. he's died, dust to dust, but I shall see it reanimated. So he believed that he was going to see John Donne again with a resurrected body. And Jürgen Habermas, who's one of the main European philosophers, says on death in Europe, the enlightened modern age has failed to find a suitable replacement for a religious way of coping with the final rite of passage which brings life to a close. So now, if you want to process your grief, you go to a concert in Manchester rather than to the cathedral. Because we are now a highly sensitized, deistic kind of society that wants to come together at times of grief, but we don't want to go to the one who will actually deal with our grief. So be aware, brothers and sisters, of the things that are happening in our culture, even today, that talk into what we're teaching in Ecclesiastes. Rest in peace. Well, if you're a believer, you do. Other people, work. I saw this sign once in an office in Zimbabwe. All I want is less to do, more time to do it, and more pay for not getting it done. I think it's brilliant. Work. What's the point? It's toil. It's uphill struggle. What happens to it all? It gets in verse 18. All that you've done, it gets inherited by someone else. If you made money, you will ask the question, how will they use the money? We know that quick wealth in itself often ruins people's lives. Someone else takes over, control passes out of the family, etc., etc., etc. People say about things, oh, well, he'd turn in his grave if he could see that. And that is true. The result, verse 23, is despair because we cannot guarantee the future of the work of our hands. There's no peace, verse 23. Now, no, think about that. That phrase, we cannot guarantee the future of the work of our hands, should have resonated with you if you know the Bible. The Bible is full of places where people ask God to help them do the work of their hands in a Christian and godly way. It comes up many times. It comes up in Acts. It comes up in the Old Testament. You see, there's all sorts of little themes running through Ecclesiastes which are important. And he says that, you know, making a name for yourself through our work, wasn't that the problem of the Tower of Babel? We want to make a name for ourselves. We'll build this tower to the heavens. That's been man's problem from the beginning. We want to exalt ourselves with what we do. I mean, it is amazing, isn't it, that we're still building towers to make sure that we've got the highest tower in the world, and the next one will be along soon. I mean, how ridiculous is it? When you think about it, who cares? Who cares you've got the highest tower in your country? I've been at least four where they did have it for a while, and now they haven't. And they're all weeping. And then he says things can be different, the last bit of chapter 2. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. That was what I was meaning by, you know, just enjoy the life you've got. Accept your life is under God's control. Ask for wisdom because God will give wisdom. Live your life wisely and use your knowledge to understand. And so, because we're looking at Ecclesiastes as the book of the month, there's also chapters 1 and 2, and we'll carry on with chapter 3 next week. How does Ecclesiastes measure up in the New Testament? It tells us to be different, but I think what you get with Ecclesiastes is what I might call an idol buster. You won't get to the end of the book of Ecclesiastes and think that anything that you're working for is worth working for. Not in itself. It will take down your idols, because what is an idol? It is anything which puts itself in your heart in the place of God. So whether it's work or career or family or prestige or status, income, whatever it happens to be, it's not going to work. It will not work ultimately. It will make your life meaningless. The second thing is that there is still frustration. The New Testament does not annul the message of meaninglessness. The vanity, the frustration of creation is upheld in Romans 8. This creation is not as it should be. It is in frustration. Paul sets that frustration in the light of A, creation, God's creation, and B, God's redemption, because he says this creation is going to get better. There will be a new heaven, and there will be a new earth. And when you get to Revelation 21, 22, most of the text is about the new earth that you will inhabit with your new resurrection body. So even while we endure a little bit of frustration, there is a great hope, and that, of course, is one of the messages of Ecclesiastes, and I think Deborah also mentioned that in her presentation. And the final thing I think that we can see from the book of Ecclesiastes, or final but one, penultimate, is that the gospel brings a new kind of work. Epaphroditus in Philippians, he almost died for the work of Christ. Timothy is admonished to work for the Lord. 1 Corinthians 15:50 says, always gives yourself fully to the work of the Lord, for you'll know your labor is not in vain. And I'm not implying that only means that these people were Christian full-time workers. One of the things the Reformation taught us partially is that all work is important. For a Christian, your vocation, whatever it happens to be, is important. It doesn't matter what state it is. It doesn't matter how much you achieve your ambition. Some may do well, some may not do so well. But what you do day to day, faithfully, with integrity, is important. That's the difference between the work where you work for yourself and work where you're working for the glory of God. And then the final thing about this is that Jesus accomplished all of his work in the world when he says, it is finished, by submitting himself to the world I've just described to you, the world under the sun. Jesus was willing to come down from the glory of heaven to be transformed into a human being forever, disrupting that essential relationship of the Trinity in order to bring salvation. And he experienced the full frustration in the world in the force of the enmity that came towards him on the cross. Philippians chapter 2. is a good hymn to the reality of what Jesus Christ did. And he himself experienced meaninglessness when he cried from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Let's just be quiet a moment and think about what we've heard. And then we'll respond with a song at the end. Our Father, I thank you that we can ponder together this book of Ecclesiastes over the next few weeks. We pray that we would remember the things we have been taught this morning, that we'd be encouraged as we go out into the world under the sun this week, and we bring a message that changes people's lives from meaninglessness to purpose. We pray you would help us with this. Amen.